Ladies and gentlemen, we do not, in fact, have a deal. But it's Friday, so we got that going for us. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 25th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So this was Infrastructure Week for, I don't know, a couple of 3 hours yesterday, between the time President Biden said there was a deal and the time that political reality reasserted itself in Washington, D.C., this nation's capital. We, though, are concerned with the economic reality of it all, so that is where we will start this week in review. Catherine Rampell is at The Washington Post. Brian Chung is at Yahoo Finance. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you, and I do not repeat not want to get into the politics of this infrastructure deal and all that is going on in Washington, because it is Byzantine and unresolved on its very best of days. But I do want to point out that on the one sheet that was circulating yesterday about the pay-fors on this thing, where they were going to get the money to do this, the bottom bullet point was also economic growth through infrastructure investment. And unlike, say, tax cuts, which have never in the history of tax cuts paid for themselves, infrastructure investment is actually an economic boon.
Well, tax cuts can also be an economic boon as well, just not as much of a boon as many of their promoters say they will be. The real question is, how much additional growth do any of these programs actually add? And is it enough to overcome or to fully offset some significant portion of the spending that's being invested, right? Yep. And we don't really know that in the case of infrastructure yet, but, you know, you can kind of make some assumptions about how much additional growth, you know, improving the highway system would be, or fixing the bridge down the road, or what have you. There were some other budget gimmicks in there that bothered me a little bit more than the dynamic scoring issue that you just identified. Like, they counted a bunch of things like, you know, basically we're going to save waste, fraud, and abuse on unemployment insurance benefits, which I find, you know, more gimmicky, and claiming revenue that we've already received from the spectrum auction. So there were a bunch of things that suggested that if CBO ever actually scores this thing, it is not going to add up to nearly as much as this bipartisan group of senators claim it will add up to.
Brian, do you suppose if this thing falls apart, and I know I said I didn't want to get into the politics, but we're going to go in there just a little tiny bit. Do you suppose if this falls apart, which as of today, you know, the two sides are moving farther apart, not closer together, does this do anything to the recovery that seems to be booming right along?
Well, one challenge is that even if it does go through as passed, it's going to take time for a lot of these measures to bleed through the economy when it comes to either getting employment or having the productivity effects that the Democrats and those crafting this bill would like it to have. And that's because of the nature of infrastructure, right? It doesn't take 6 to 12 months to build a new bridge or to fix an airport, to get these electric vehicles out on the street. It takes many, many years. And in fact, infrastructure is by nature a longer term play. So when we talk about the economic immediate impact of this, I think a lot of officials, economists, and public policymakers as well are saying, well, we have to remember that the idea of this is not to immediately provide some sort of windfall to the economy, this pandemic recovery economy in the next 1 or 2 years. It's really a much longer play than that.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so Catherine, somebody on Twitter today gave me a hard time, shocking news, I know, about breaking my word on this program last week when I said, okay, we're going to do a brief moratorium on inflation. But we can't actually do that because it's a real issue. And I want to direct your attention to two things. Number one, Jay Powell, the chair of the Fed today, this week, giving testimony to Congress, in which it was pretty clear that the chair is, as we knew, not worried about inflation, but Congress, whether to score political points or genuinely, seems to be worried about inflation. And also Rafael Bostic, the president of the Atlanta Fed, saying on another public radio program whose initials are Morning Edition this week, that inflation is going to be higher than we expected for longer than we expected. Do you have any new ideas on perhaps whether or not we should stop thinking about inflation? Because I really want to, and it seems that we can't.
Well, we can't because we're still getting data, obviously, and there are a lot of unknowns out there about whether the price spikes that we've seen recently will be transitory, as Jay Powell, mm-hmm. among others, has suggested that they will be. And the other question is, you know, how much of this is a self-fulfilling prophecy? That even if lumber prices start to fall back to earth, as they have done, or used car prices, same deal. You know, they shot up and they seem to be moderating now. Yeah. Does the public get so convinced that these prices will be pervasive and sustained that they preemptively start raising price? You know, if you're a small business owner, you start raising your prices, or people start asking for wage increases to account for those prices. So it's this funny situation where it's like, the more we talk about it, maybe that ends up willing it into being. But on the other hand, you can't dismiss people's fears about it because, especially if you are at the Fed, because you need to maintain your credibility. And Chairman Powell wants to show that he has all of this stuff under control. And he is taking into account these concerns, and the Fed has the tools to deal with them. And I think that's the line that he's walking now.
Brian Chung, first time on the program, so let me put you on the spot. What's your gut telling you about whether it's transitory, as the Fed chair seems to be hoping and believing, or is it going to stick around for a while? And I would note today that we got the Fed's favorite measure of inflation, personal consumption expenditures, PCE, running about 4%, 3.9% year on year. What do you think?
And we did get more data. I think what my gut is telling me is that we need to see more months of data. And as you mentioned, the data coming in this morning from the Bureau of Economic Analysis showing that personal consumption expenditures, the index grew by 3.9% on a year-over-year basis. That actually was right as Wall Street expected it, which is maybe why we didn't see too much craziness in the market today, although we did see bond yields go up. But I think broadly speaking, what's interesting is that these are eye-popping figures. Even when you strip out those more volatile components like the Fed likes to do, energy and food prices from that index, you still get a year-over-year increase of 3.4%, which is the highest since 1992. And I think the question is going to be, well, going forward, should we expect to see numbers that are even above those figures? And I just actually got off a conversation with Boston Fed President Eric Rosengren earlier this afternoon. He was saying, look, when you look at airline fares and hotel rates, those are still coming back fast, but they're still below pre-pandemic levels, which shows that we should expect to see inflation move even higher to more eye-popping numbers maybe in the coming months.
Eye-popping numbers is not a phrase you want to hear, Brian, when you're talking about inflation.
Not at all. And I think that this is really the test for the Federal Reserve. And they've said for a while, look, we're okay with allowing inflation to rise above our 2% target moderately. But for right now, Fed officials have said, yes, we're getting well above 2%, but this is all transitory. It's from supply chain bottlenecks. It's from the measuring effects when you're comparing current months to the depths of the pandemic last spring. But ultimately, will that story hold up in June, July, August, September? That's going to be the big test for their reaction function.
All right. Well, so much for my inflation moratorium. Brian Chung at Yahoo Finance, Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy.
Have a nice weekend.
Thanks.
On Wall Street today, a lot of green, then a teensy bit of red. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a little bit of a logic puzzle to be done, I guess you'd say, as companies start thinking about bringing people back to the office and those people start thinking about going back. There is generally some flexibility, right? Some in-the-office full-time options, some go-ahead, work from home, it's all good options, and some hybrid options. But as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, this pandemic might firmly be establishing the business model for third workspaces.
It's 75 and sunny in Brooklyn today, and there are so many people out. It's as if everyone's on vacation. But lots of faces are behind laptops, like Jake Sundin sitting outside a bagel shop.
It's nice to come out here and like work outside, especially on like a beautiful day like this.
Sundin is a graphic designer. He's been working from home to skip the 45-minute commute into Manhattan. Still, he needs to escape his dark apartment and his roommates now and then.
Sometimes if I'm working right in my room, so easy to just, like, you know, hit the bed and, you know, rest my eyes for a little bit longer.
More than 70% of workers want to keep the option to work remotely, according to a survey from Microsoft. But that doesn't necessarily mean they want to spend all their time at home, which creates a business opportunity. Nick Iovacchini is CEO of Kettlespace, an app that connects users to workspaces in hotels, restaurants, and even retail stores.
And you'd be surprised at how often, you know, the space that's right on the ground floor, beautiful kind of decor and lighting is just sitting there, underutilized and empty.
That was the case before the pandemic at Kindred, a Mediterranean restaurant in Manhattan. It used to only be open for dinner, says Moshe Shulman, one of the owners. Now, workers can rent a table for $25 a day, and there are tempting extras for sale, an a la carte lunch menu.
And also wine, if they'd like to drink while they're working, but not encouraged.
Running a restaurant slash office has costs. Wi-Fi upgrades, charging stations, unlimited coffee. But Kindred is on track to pull in an extra $10,000 in sales this month. Shulman thinks people like not having to do the coffee shop hop. You know, the awkward scrounge for Wi-Fi passwords and power outlets.
It's a mutual understanding between, you know, the restaurant and then folks who are working to say, relax, get your work done, and enjoy, you know, a dish or a glass of wine after.
As for Sundin, who was outside the bagel shop, he plans on nursing his $5 coffee until his laptop dies. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
You know what you can do between a bagel and a $5 coffee or dinner and wine? If you miss us on the air, check out our podcast, marketplace.org, or the platform of your choice. The Centers for Disease Control has extended for one last time, it says, the federal eviction moratorium. That gives the millions of tenants out there who can't make the rent a little bit of breathing room. End of July is the new deadline. There is federal rent relief money to be had, but it's not getting to everybody who needs it. So what do you suppose happens when the federal eviction protections go away in just over a month? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is on that one.
The one-month extension will give state and local governments more time to distribute $25 billion in federal pandemic rental assistance. Some have been slow to get the money out. Matt Losak heads the Montgomery County, Maryland Renters Alliance. He says they're afraid of fraud and...
A lot of municipalities are not used to handling crisis operations.
Losak says 6 million renters nationwide are facing eviction. Tenants like Laura, who didn't want her last name used for fear of losing her job. She applied for rental assistance 2 months ago.
I'm just honestly very frustrated right now.
Laura works in a nursing home. She was afraid of getting COVID, so took a month off from work, unpaid. Now she's $3,200 behind on her rent. She worries she'll be evicted.
It's a very dehumanizing process. Who wants to have an eviction notice slapped on their front door for everybody who lives on your floor to see?
Laura is working and paying rent again. She just needs the federal aid to pay her back rent. Paula Cino is with the National Multifamily Housing Council.
We've seen data that suggests that residents are feeling that they are in a better place about meeting those rental agreements.
But Cino says long-term, the Section 8 federal housing program should be expanded. It issues rent vouchers for low-income tenants. Alicia Mazzara is at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She says even before the pandemic, there was a long Section 8 wait list.
Just one in four eligible families get rental assistance, and so many more people are in need.
Mazzara says this is the best way to replace the temporary eviction moratorium safety net. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
30-day turnarounds on their home sales.
Oh, it's a seller's market out there, baby. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 237 points on this Friday, 0.6%, 34,433. The NASDAQ went the other way, down 9 points, less than a 10% actually, ended at 14,360. S&P 500 up 14, 0.3%, 42,080. For the week, the 5 days gone by, the Dow gained 3.4%, the NASDAQ up 2.3%, S&P 500 gained 0.7%. Bank stocks went up after the Federal Reserve posted positive results for its annual stress tests of 23 major American banks today. Citigroup up 0.3%, Bank of America added 1.9% today. Virgin Galactic shot up more than 38% after the Federal Aviation Administration gave the green light to its plans to ferry passengers into space. I would totally go if I could afford it. Sportswear retailer Nike left 15.5% on quarterly revenue and earnings that easily beat expectations. Bond prices went down. Yield on the 10-year T-note thus went up 1.52%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We learned this morning consumer spending was pretty much flat last month, a small bump in services, hotels, restaurants, that kind of thing. Thanks, of course, to all the vaccinations and decent savings that people have built up the past year and a half, and those same people now itching to travel. Data from earlier this month also tells us that people are spending more on certain goods, clothing among them, because not being stuck at home, am I right? But our relationship with our clothes, almost 18 months on now, it's changing, as Marketplace's Marielle Segarra tells us.
It was Memorial Day weekend, and Christy Carlson Gehring needed new clothes. Her office at Wichita State University in Kansas was about to reopen. So she went to the store, grabbed a pair of pants, and headed to the dressing room.
I mean, I intentionally picked a size up that I normally thought I wore, and even it was too tight, and it was a little depressing at first.
Like a lot of people, Carlson Gehring gained weight during the pandemic. And being in that dressing room brought up some feelings.
It's just whatever the peer pressure is, that you have to be a certain size, you know, to really be accepted.
Then she went to another store where a sales associate started just bringing her stuff and made a point of saying, you know, don't look at the label. Some of our stuff fits a little loose. Some of it fits tight.
And so I tried on a vast array of sizes and I didn't feel bad. And I think it was because of that associate at that store made me feel it didn't matter what the size was. It was what looked good.
And what felt good. She'd gotten used to wearing sweatpants and comfy t-shirts while working from home.
And I just was more relaxed, didn't feel, you know, as stressed because, you know, I guess you don't realize just, you know, how wearing tight clothes, it's like how uncomfortable that really is.
And in that moment at the store, she decided to disregard the judgy thoughts that kept popping into her head about her size or whether that shiny gold blouse or those Converse shoes were age appropriate.
Because, yes, I may be, you know, 56 years old, but, you know, I can dress this way if I want to. It's comfortable and I just don't care what everybody else thinks.
The pandemic has been a wake-up call.
You know, life is really precious. And do what you want to do, wear what you want to wear, be comfortable in who you are.
The long stretches of isolation over the past year have given a lot of people the time to figure that out. Rahil Rogiani recalls a moment from last year.
I remember going to some very open patio space last summer for my birthday and wearing this black and white longer skirt for the first time that I'd had for like 2 years, but hadn't really worn yet.
Rogiani is gender fluid and for a long time had mostly worn clothes that are generally seen as masculine, like button downs and slacks. But during the pandemic, they had time to think about what they wanted to wear, what felt right. So that day on the patio, at first, Rogiani worried about being judged, but
it took the process of being out in public with it to be like to have this really magical moment after I was letting go of some of the layers of unease. To be like, oh my God, this feels so freeing. I could do this all the time. What would it be like to be free?
That question feels more urgent now, especially for Rogiani, who's a resident at a public hospital in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I think COVID, and particularly for me being on the front lines, really brought into focus our collective, you know, this is kind of it. How do we want to live?
For Rogiani, in the context of clothing, that means figuring out a new style. Since that day on the patio, they've gone thrift shopping and have gotten a few outfits from their partner, like a mustard yellow jumpsuit and an ankle-length maroon skirt, both of which are loose-fitting and flowy. Because the other thing Rogiani has realized after this year, they want to be comfortable. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Speaking of changes in the way we buy stuff, as Mariel was a minute ago, early on in this pandemic, we told you about an old-style way of doing business that made kind of a comeback amid the shortages and the dire circumstances of last year. Bartering, as in trading stuff instead of buying it. Veronica Kuhn, she's a hairdresser in Henderson, Nevada. She started a bartering group on Facebook that early on had a lot of people looking for hand sanitizer and disinfecting wipes and basic supplies as well, like food. But with people getting back to doing stuff instead of needing stuff, here's Veronica with an update.
So on the barter group now, we are seeing a lot more like events posted and job opportunities posted and things like that, as opposed to people's actual needs. I mean, there's still some with the food banks that are open and going, but a lot more with events and job opportunities at this point. We have had some people that, you know, have posted where they know that people are hiring. We've had some carnivals come back to town and some fun little community events like that. Our housing market is super high right now, so people are selling their homes for 2 to 3 times what they've paid for it and moving out. So you can sell your home here typically and move someplace like Ohio and buy 3 times what you had here for half the money. So one of the things that I'm seeing on the group are moving sales. You know, curb check, you know, go check this out. It'll be here until whatever time. And then I'm donating it, you know, and lots of stuff like pianos and everything. Like it, they're just not really having time to sell their stuff through like yard sales and stuff like that because their move out is so fast, like with 30-day turnarounds on their home sales. It's really disheartening because there's a lot of mom and pop places that have closed, but I go to as much as I can to support the local businesses. So we have a country bar out here called Stoney's, and I've been there a few times. They just now started like a week ago allowing dancing. I went to an event over the weekend at one of the casinos, one of the nightclubs in the casino, and it was really cool to just like see the casinos getting back to business and people there. And I feel like for my personal little family, we are as normal as we're going to get. My husband hasn't stopped working the whole time. I only lost my job for 2 months. We're back to traveling. We have our tickets for Disneyland in September. Like, it's a huge deal for us. So I feel like we're back. We're back to as normal as we're going to get. So I just wish the rest of everybody else could be there too.
We're getting there. That was Veronica Kuhn. She's in Henderson, Nevada. This final note on the way out today, in which, once again, men are terrible. Saw this in Bloomberg today, a report from the Center for Global Development. That's a poverty nonprofit. It says that worldwide, women took on 173 extra hours of unpaid childcare last year. Men? Any guesses? 59 hours. And look, we have gone over a lot how devastating the pandemic has been for women in the American labor force. And you know, we're not terrible, men, most of us, but got to do better, yeah? All right, we are going, but here is your moment of economic context. Think about this maybe as you fire up that gas-fired grill this coming summer. You can add propane to the list of high demand and supply chain impaired commodities in this economy. Bloomberg points out that propane is just about a dollar a gallon. That's the spot price. I don't know what you're paying for one of those little tanks at the hardware store. Anyway, it's the highest the propane's been since 2014. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassid is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.